The terrorist attacks in Mumbai, India are over for now, though the group declaring responsibility is promising more. We will talk about why this is happening now and wonder how the current and incoming administrations should deal with the threat. President Bush had this to say to the people of India on Saturday.
The leaders of India can know that nations around the world support them in the face of this assault on human dignity. And as the people of the world's largest democracy recover from these attacks, they can count on the world's oldest democracy to stand by their side.
Commandos on Saturday killed the last remaining gunman in Mumbai's Taj Hotel to end the attack by Islamic militants on India's financial capital. The attacks left 195 dead, including 26 foreigners. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 past 6 on this Monday, December the 1st. And we will talk about the Mumbai attacks this hour and what the U.S. should do about the threat. And we will also talk about President-elect Barack Obama announcing his national security and foreign policy team today. We'll talk about those choices as well and welcome your questions and reactions. Our guest is Lamont Colucci. He is a professor of international relations and national security at Ripon College and the author of the book Crusading Realism, The Bush Doctrine and American Core Values After 9/11. He joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for joining us early on this first day of December.
Thank you.
But we wanted to talk about this situation in India this morning, not knowing exactly how it was going to be turning out. It looks like it's over for now, but the news is saying that this group is promising more attacks like this in the future.
Well, I mean, obviously they're going to make claims regarding that. Whether or not they can pull it off is a big question. It's kind of like fighting the last war. We look at the terrorist incidents in 2001, and we ramp up security for airports. And obviously, this attack was primarily a seaborne invasion of the city. On the other hand, this group, if it truly is coming out of Pakistan, which it appears that it is, its goals, I think, are much more strategic. And the media tended to focus on the personal aspect of the attack and the personal tragedy, but I think what we're really looking at is a strategic move to, if possible, bring about conflict between India and Pakistan.
Why would that be a goal?
Well, Al-Qaeda and its affiliates and its like-minded terrorist groups, and there's a huge debate among counter-terrorist experts on how much control Al-Qaeda has as an actor, whether it's an inspirational being or whether or not they're directing these things. But the real question is that these groups have been very effective at using terrorist incidents to bring about changes between nation states or changes within a nation state. They were able to totally overturn the Spanish elections with a single act in Madrid. They were able to essentially light the fire of the extreme violence between Sunnis and Shiites with the bombing of the Golden Mosque. And if they're able to bring about a war or even certain other lesser problems between India or Pakistan, that would be a victory. Now, one possibility short of war would be simply that due to the rise in tension, India and Pakistan go on a war footing and Pakistan moves its forces that are some ways conducting counter-terrorist operations on the Afghani border to the Indian border. That would be maybe a minimal goal of these groups, but it certainly would serve as a great victory in their minds. And there are others. This might bring down the current Indian government with the Congress Party. Maybe it destabilizes the current government, the newly democratically elected government in Islamabad. So there's a host of things that would be of great benefit to the extremists.
Yeah, I read an article from a London paper that said that these attacks were a ploy to wreck the Obama plan to isolate Al-Qaeda. Does that make sense?
Well, if in fact Pakistan were to divert resources that it currently is using to fight the Taliban and al-Qaeda and other extremist groups on the Afghani border, then this goal of trying to focus on the Afghan-Pakistan border that President-elect Obama has announced would be in jeopardy. And then you're faced with the question of even greater unilateral American action inside a sovereign state of Pakistan. And, you know, there was this whole consternation about Musharraf. And now that he's gone, I think a great question for the new administration and for the American government currently is, what do you do to attempt to bolster this new government, which is going to have a lot of problems, whether it be domestically or internationally? And they constantly are trying to walk a tightrope between being seen as too far in the camp of the West by the extremists and not doing enough in the eyes of the West to fight terrorism and other extremist groups.
We are talking with a professor of international relations and national security about the meaning of the Mumbai terrorist attacks and how the U.S. should or could respond to this. Plus, we will also talk about the new foreign policy team that will be announced by President-elect Barack Obama later this morning. We welcome your questions about what happened in India and what it means for the U.S. and the rest of the world, for that matter, at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's about 18 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Monday, December the 1st. Coming up later today, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. After 5, the U.S. spends more on medical care than any other country in the world, yet ranks 34th in the world for life expectancy. After 5, Ben and his guest will discuss health care obstacles in America. That's later this afternoon after 5 o'clock. We are talking about the terrorist attacks in Mumbai, India, and how the U.S. should respond to this threat. Barack Obama also assembling his foreign policy team. He will be announcing his cabinet picks in a news conference this morning, a little later this morning, including Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, Robert Gates as Defense Secretary, and retired Marine General Jim Jones as National Security Advisor. We are welcoming your questions and reactions to this at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Our guest is Lamont Colucci, professor of international relations and national security at Ripon College, and he is author of Crusading Realism, The Bush Doctrine and American Core Values After 9/11. Also in the news this morning, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice tells reporters en route to London that Pakistan must cooperate with India's probe into the terrorist attacks in Mumbai. She says that means Pakistan must let the evidence lead wherever it takes investigators. Rice will be in India later this week in a show of support. Professor Colucci, what is the evidence that Pakistan is involved in this in any way?
Well, it appears that the group that claimed initial responsibility for the attack, this Deccan Mujahideen, there's a great question whether or not that group even exists. And so all points of the compass seem to indicate that the group that is really involved is a group called Lashkar-e-Taiba, which is a group that was formed in 1991 primarily to wrest control of Kashmir from India. And they have used terrorist-style tactics against the Indian government and the Indian people in an effort to pursue that goal. And it is, I guess, understood that the attacker that survived the counterattack has admitted as much. It does track. I mean, it would track with not only the goals of a group like al-Qaeda, but with the Kashmiri militant movement, to bring about an end to any possible peace or rapprochement with India and Pakistan. And it is possible that there are links with the ISI, which is the Pakistani Intelligence Service. It may not be the ISI officially, but the ISI has had huge problems getting control of itself. There's what the Indian government, the Pakistani government might want, and then there are elements within the ISI that were very close to the Taliban that continue to be very close to them, as well as the Kashmiri militants. So it tracks with conventional thinking about it.
Yeah. So should we take anything with the timing of these attacks that had happened right now with Barack Obama coming into office?
Well, it's quite possible that there's a couple of possible factors. There is that, the idea of to see, give the administration a crisis almost on day one. That, I think that's giving them a little more strategic sense than they might have as regarding us. But I think more importantly, there's an attempt to destabilize potentially the Pakistani government, which will be under pressure and has been under pressure to ramp up their activity against the extremists on the border. But also, the Indian elections are coming up. It would be if they can the party in India that is, let's just say, capitalized on the event, the Hindu Nationalist Party, has already come out and essentially blamed the Congress Party for being weak and failing on national security grounds to deal with this. They're a very militant party. There have been some links between them and anti-Muslim actions inside India, and that would, of course, again, cause that same volatile mix that groups like Al-Qaeda have successfully done in the past.
Pakistani-Indian relations, I thought, had been improving in recent years. Was that just my imagination?
No, I think part of it is the strange aspect with 9/11 and the events following 9/11 in 2001 is that the United States had to make some very serious decisions about the situation between India and Pakistan. We needed both countries. We continue to need both countries for the war on terror and for regional stability. And starting way back in the 90s, there was a move to shift American foreign policy towards a greater relationship with India, which was heightened under the Bush administration, especially in the recent accord over nuclear energy. Pakistan, the relations go farther back into the Cold War vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. And after the nuclear tests of the late 1990s, and you had a number of blow-ups regarding the border in Jammu and Kashmir, there was a road to improvement. But that is not in the interest of the Islamic extremists or Islamic extremist ideology. Aside from the fact of their virulent hatred for Hinduism and Hindus, aside from that, which is a huge issue, there is a need to make sure that there's violence and consternation and volatility between those two powers. So yes, I think precisely because there have been some improvements and the road ahead looked to be positive, that groups like Al-Qaeda or other groups like that can't afford to let that happen.
So what steps do you anticipate we will see, you know, from now on in the near future?
Well, the first issue is going to be whether or not the Congress Party, the current government in India, can survive. And there have already been a number of resignations, you know, one could call them sacrificial lambs to public opinion over why they weren't prepared for this, and you know, heads will roll, some of them justified and some of them not, just like in any country that has to go through that. If the second question is, will the Pakistani government under Zardari and Jilani, who are newly elected, who claim that they want to have a much more integrated role in the international community and fight against the extremists, will they allow what you mentioned, a full and fair investigation into these events? If those two things can happen, then perhaps the situation will calm down a little sooner than we think. I think for the United States, for the current administration and the incoming administration, the single goal is not so much in assisting them with these groups, which is something we will do, but attempting to mediate between the two parties, because the worst of all possible worlds would be an increase in tension and an increase in conflict between the two. But it's precisely this kind of strategic moves by the extremists, regardless of whether or not there's a single unitary commander or not, that have been successful time and time again to bring about these types of situations that go far beyond a single attack or a single incident.
Yeah. Well, I'm certainly learning a lot about what's going on there. But the initial reports said that these terrorists were asking people for their passports and singling out people with British or American passports. Was that overblown, or was there a message trying to be sent there?
Well, for the first day or two, there were reports that they were trying to single out carriers of British passports, American passports, and anybody who they thought was Jewish. And although I don't doubt that, I think that that got into almost a side issue. That was what the media began to mm-hmm. focus on. And although there's deep hatred by the extremists for Americans, for Europeans, obviously for Jewish people, the real goal, I think, was to bring about this conflict between India and Pakistan. I mean, that's not to say that there weren't operations that were designed for that, the attack on the Jewish center in Mumbai is a classic example of that. So, you know, this is, we don't want to neglect that, but we also want to understand that in almost every case, whether it's the Cole attack, whether it's the attack on the Twin Towers, whether it's the attack in Madrid or in London or in the Samara, that these extremists have much larger goals and have been relatively successful at those larger goals.
Yeah, Claire McCaskill was on one of the Sunday morning TV shows saying that this incident goes to show that the war on terrorism really needs to be fought in Afghanistan, Pakistan, in that area, and not the war in Iraq, and that this shows that Barack Obama was really right all along. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think that really cuts to the heart of probably the central question, if not number one, then number two, facing the new administration. And it goes beyond Iraq and Afghanistan, and that is, how do we fight what has been called the global war on terror, or the war on terror, whatever mm-hmm. you want to term it as. And the two administrations in the past, the Clinton administration of the 90s, and the Bush administration of the early 21st century, had fundamentally different ways of dealing with terrorism. And there is no way that that if you somehow were to dry up elements of terrorism in Afghanistan or parts of Pakistan, that you would end this conflict. So the question before the new administration is, what is going to be their grand strategy in dealing with terrorism? Now, the Clinton administration's answer was a law enforcement paradigm or a law mm-hmm. enforcement plan. The Bush administration, this Bush administration's plan was primarily military-based. Both of them had ideological components to them.
Yeah, let me hold you there. We will talk more about how the Obama administration might go about fighting the global war on terrorism after the news. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 6:36 on this Monday, December the 1st. As President-elect Barack Obama assembles his foreign policy team, the challenges continue to stack up, not the least of which the terrorist attacks in India over the weekend, over the Thanksgiving weekend. We are talking about those attacks in India and what it means in the war on terrorism. Plus, we will also talk about the people that Barack Obama will be announcing later this morning to head up his foreign policy team. We will welcome your questions for our guest at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Lamont Colucci is our guest, professor of international relations and national security at Ripon College and author of Crusading Realism, The Bush Doctrine and American Core Values After 9/11. Just before news time, Professor Colucci, we were talking about what is facing the Obama administration and what questions need to be answered in terms of how will the Obama administration go about fighting global terrorism. And you were saying?
Well, I was simply saying that there, the two models that have existed in the recent memory would be the Clinton administration's law enforcement model and the Bush administration viewing it more like a war. And I think the fundamental question for the Obama administration coming in is which of the two paradigms they're going to use, or are they going to create a third one? Although, you know, if you kind of troll through the counter-terrorist literature and what counter-terrorist experts talk about, there really isn't another option. Yeah, there are mixing and matching of things, but it really goes to the heart of the question. It's why we have these debates about torture, enhanced interrogation techniques, Guantanamo. These are far from just academic issues. The law enforcement pathway leads you down one very particular path, and so does the more war paradigm. And I don't have a sense at this stage, because the campaign was not dominated at all by national security issues, which I think is unfortunate, that the candidates were not questioned, either of them, on deeper international relations issues. But there's no sense at this stage of where President-elect Obama wants to go regarding that one.
Yeah.
And it goes way beyond events in Iraq or Afghanistan.
Yeah, he did, Obama, on more than one occasion, say, though, that he would, you know, he would hunt down Osama bin Laden, and he would, you know, look for him in the caves in that border area of Pakistan and Afghanistan,
yeah.
And he wouldn't hesitate to take some kind of military action on that border area if the Pakistan government was going to ignore it.
But that was very interesting, because, of course, that's exactly what the Bush administration has been doing. And the funny thing with Obama and McCain were that they agreed with each other. It was almost farcical. What I mean by that is, they were fighting when they finally had one or two questions regarding this issue. They were fighting about who would declare it, meaning McCain accused Obama of not following diplomatic rules, that, oh, you would do this, but you wouldn't telegraph it, you wouldn't make it public.
Mm-hmm.
And Obama kept saying that I never really meant I was going to invade Pakistan. And actually, they both essentially stated the exact same policy, and they were really debating of who would talk about it openly or not. It was rather bizarre, actually.
Yeah, and of course, candidate Barack Obama and his Democratic rival Hillary Clinton had some differences when it came to foreign policy issues, including meeting with foreign leaders like Iran's leader without preconditions. And now, look what we have here. We have Hillary Clinton is going to be announced later this morning as Secretary of State. What's your reaction to Obama's pick of Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State?
Well, my colleagues on the domestic politics side of the aisle, which I won't try to trample on too much, would suggest that the reason for that pick is pure American domestic politics, to ensure that a great power source in the Democratic Party is nullified by being part of your administration. So I'll leave that to them. But on the foreign policy end of it, I mean, she voted for the Iraq War. She, as well as her husband, have been advocates of free trade, strong support for Israel, and they disagreed over that issue with Pakistan during the campaign. They disagreed over the issue of recognition with Iran.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there is that basic aspect of national security policy, which is the Secretary of State must obey the President of the United States, and when there are fundamental disagreements, they end up resigning. And we have dealt with that for all of American history, whether it's General Marshall's disagreement with Harry Truman over recognition of Israel, or whether it's misstatements, perhaps, by the Secretary of State, like Al Haig with Ronald Reagan, what have you. She's going to have to follow the president's line, and although she's powerful, and she wouldn't have taken the position unless she was probably given a certain level of autonomy. But in the end, the president sets the foreign policy goals.
Yeah. And then we have Robert Gates apparently staying on, at least for a while, as defense secretary.
Yeah, I think that was a shocker in some ways for some people on two levels. One, he didn't want to continue as Secretary of Defense, regardless of who won. He made it very clear that he wanted to return to private life. So there's that aspect of it. And the other, I think, is a question that's being raised by some of President-elect Obama's supporters, and that is, if you look at the inner team of national security, regardless of all of the picks, there's kind of an inner team that the president has. It's almost always the CIA director, the CIA, the national security advisor, the Secretary of State, and so forth, Secretary of Defense. You're looking at, you know, in many ways, a very heavy, almost Republican realist wing of foreign policy coming into this administration. And there's definitely no pick among the senior national security leaders of in domestic politics is sometimes termed the hard left or the far left or anti-war left, whatever you want to call them. And I think that's interesting. I don't know what will the ultimate reaction will be among his constituency over that. But, you know, Gates, although he initially opposed the surge, he eventually endorsed it with General Petraeus. He obviously believes that the war in Iraq needs to be finished in a certain way, regardless of timetables. He comes out of a Cold War Republican realist tradition at both CIA and in private life. So it's a very interesting pick, and will, I think, be a foil to some other elements within the administration that don't see the world that way.
Yeah. So do you think that means that we won't see Barack Obama's campaign promise of within, 16 months, having troops pretty much out of Iraq?
I would doubt it. I think that, you know, on the one hand, everybody realizes that there are promises made in campaigns, especially about foreign policy, that are quickly evaporate when you enter the Oval Office. For example, Bill Clinton's almost visceral comments about the People's Republic of China as a candidate running for president and the actual policy of the Clinton administration regarding China was really two different worlds. You know, the recent negotiated agreement doesn't really allow for that 16-month to really occur. I mean, the United States is going to have to essentially accomplish three things before that can really happen. There has to be a benchmark on stabilization. There has to be a prevention of Iran from using any power vacuum, monopolizing any power vacuum. And there has to be assurances made to many of the Middle Eastern states in the Gulf, Saudi Arabia, the Kurds, of America's continued commitment to the region. And obviously, countries like Saudi Arabia don't really want us, don't want that power vacuum. So, you know, those are the realities. And if you're picking realists, I mean, you've got General Jim Jones, you've got Robert Gates, you've got Admiral Dennis mm-hmm. Blair, you know, there's talk about Tony Lake at CIA. If you're talking one stripe or another of realists, that's how they're going to look at the world. They're going to look at it from very concrete benchmarks, and maybe one could argue even non-ideological benchmarks. And I think that's the reality of it.
We'll check weather, and then we'll take some calls. Some of you are lining up to talk with our guest, Lamont Colucci, professor of international relations and national security at Ripon College, author of Crusading Realism, The Bush Doctrine, and American Core Values After 9/11. We're talking about Barack Obama's new foreign policy team, the cabinet picks that he will be announcing this morning, and talking about the challenges, especially when it comes to terrorism, facing the incoming Obama administration, following the attacks in India over the Thanksgiving Day holiday weekend. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 13 minutes before 7 o'clock on this Monday, December the 1st. Coming up after 7 o'clock, it's our State Capitol Report We will welcome in two guests, one who says the minimum wage should be raised in Wisconsin and indexed to inflation, and another guest who says the minimum wage should actually be cut. We'll wonder where you stand on this coming up in our State Capitol Report after 7 o'clock. And then after 8 o'clock, if you have questions about the transition from analog TV, our regular old-fashioned analog TV broadcasts, and the transition to digital TV coming up in February, you'll want to be with us after 8 o'clock. Answers to your questions about that after 8. Right now, we're talking about terrorism and the challenges facing the incoming Obama administration following the terrorist attacks in India. And our first caller, we have an open line for you, by the way, if you have a question about what happened in India and what it means and how the Obama administration ought to react to it, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Also, welcoming your reactions to the cabinet picks that Barack Obama will be announcing today, like Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, Bill Gates staying on as Defense Secretary, retired Marine General Jim Jones as National Security Advisor. Think that's a good team? We'd love to hear from you. Bob in Superior, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. There's an important factor missing from this whole equation, and that is the outrage and opposition from the moderate world. I consider myself a fairly informed person, and what I am not seeing is the moderate Muslims in Egypt, the moderate Muslims in Indonesia, the moderate Muslims in the United States. Where is the outrage at the so-called hijacking of their religion? I've seen interviews with Muslim spokesmen on TV, and we hear the same same bland responses from these folks. They don't represent us. Islam is a peaceful religion. I don't think we're going to get anywhere in this situation until the Islamist world, the moderate Muslims, stand up and start saying, look, we're not going to tolerate this type of behavior.
And you don't think, do you agree, Professor Colucci, are we not hearing that?
Well, I think it goes back to that fundamental question of how you fight the war on terror. And you know, the recognition by the United States since the beginning of the war on terror was that the strategic way that you can deal with this situation is ultimately going to have to come from the Islamic community themselves. And the problem that we have is that in many parts of the Middle East, but not just the Middle East, obviously we're talking about South Asia or Indonesia or any place, you have an extremist group that is willing to kill fellow Muslims in order to either keep them quiet or to put a chilling effect on anything they might do or say. And so how do you deal with that? Now, the Bush administration, and I won't talk too much about my book, but the Bush administration's response was an attempt to assist in creating civil societies in Islamic countries in order to bring about a fundamental political change that would allow forces of moderation and civil society to flourish. And that was an answer to this issue of terrorism, because what you're going to see, I think, is in the Obama administration, there's a number of people who have spoken on this issue. And I think I saw a quote that caught my eye. It said, we need to, quote, rebalance America's national security portfolio, and we have to increase soft power. And when we talk about soft power, especially in this regard, we talk about building schools and roads and clinics, and those are all good things. The problem is, and getting at your caller's question again, is that if the United States assists a country or group in building a road or a school, and the extremists blow up the school and they kill the teachers, as we've seen in a variety of places, then you need to start earlier. You need to go one step back, and you have to establish a certain level of security first. So I think your caller, in a sense, hits at the heart of the question. The fundamental way it's going to change is if the Islamic world itself rejects this. It cannot be done externally. That will be impossible.
Bob, do you have a follow-up?
Yes. Does anyone actually believe that if we killed Osama bin Laden tomorrow, there wouldn't be someone else to step in his shoes in the world?
I think exactly that's exactly the point. I think that the fascination the media has had with bin Laden and Zawahiri or whoever has been extremely counterproductive. If bin Laden is either dead now or is killed or is captured and is removed from the scene, nothing fundamentally changes at all. That's why the way to look at this is not going after a single person or even a single group. There has to be a fundamental transformation of the region politically. And unfortunately, the media's obsession about one man in particular, Osama bin Laden, leads people down the path to think that if he was strung up yesterday in the town square, that suddenly things would come to an end, and it would not in any way, shape, or form.
Thank you, Bob, for the call. We go now to Ann in Madison. Hi, Ann, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, the Indian people demonstrated immediately against their government, which had had warnings from this group. And that's in sharp contrast to the U.S., where people not only didn't demonstrate, but the Bush administration deflected their inability to have this happen by declaring war on terrorists. And I think that's something that we have to deal with here. We're a very passive, accepting, naive populace. But second, the reasons for the attacks by so-called terrorist groups differ in each case. There are Irish terrorists, there are Basque terrorists. They all want something different. And I think the problem is that the U.S. media and academe, in many cases, scoffs at the idea of determining whether these groups have any real reason for their anger. And for instance, India is getting nuclear fuel from the United States, even though it refused to sign the Test Ban Treaty. So, the possibility of a nuclear war beginning in the India-Pakistan region is a really frightening one. And I just think that, Bush has used the American press, which is so lazy, as its mouthpiece, basically to get its idea that these terrorists, have to be pursued with zeal all over the world, making no distinction between them and refusing to analyze the reasons for this.
We're running out of time, and I want to try to address these questions and maybe even have time for a follow-up for you. Professor Colucci?
Well, I think that, it's kind of interesting that the American press be a mouthpiece for this administration. I think that it's been extremely critical. Of course, terrorist groups have different wants and desires, and the Irish Republican Army or the Basques have different sets, but that is exactly the point. The new terrorist phenomenon that starts in the 1980s, that accelerates in the 1990s, and comes to fruition, unfortunately, in our lifetime now, is fundamentally and totally different from the old terrorist rules and networks of the 20th and 19th century. And that is, I think, a fundamental problem and change that we're facing. And that new terrorism tends to be focused on the establishment of a political Islamic caliphate under Sharia law. And although these groups differ in location and nuance, there's some fundamental similarities, whether it's al-Qaeda in the Maghreb fighting in North Africa, or whether it's al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia fighting in Iraq, or whether it's Lashkar-e-Taiba fighting in Kashmir. There is a fundamental agreement about a worldview, a view to create a theocracy that motivates these groups to act within concert. And that is the unfortunate reality that the new administration and this administration will be faced with. And I'm not sure how beneficial it is to accuse the Indian government of incompetence when, you cannot be everywhere at all times and your intelligence is only as good as it was yesterday and you can't expect it to be, soothsayers. So, we're going to continue to face these problems, and the fundamental realization must be what we're facing and how new that is In the last decade and a half or so.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Anne, no time for a follow-up. Just a minute or so for some concluding remarks from you, Professor Colucci. What kind of change are you expecting with the international relations and foreign policy with the incoming Obama administration?
Well, you know, they face a lot of challenges, and regardless of who was elected, most of these challenges, almost all the challenges, would be the same. So the question is, you know, how will they handle them? And I think, you know, one interesting thing is, will there be an Obama doctrine? You know, there was a Bush doctrine. Mm-hmm. Will there be an Obama doctrine? And some people have suggested that if there is one, it'll focus on genocide. There are comments that President-elect Obama has made regarding his inability to tolerate world genocide anywhere in the world, and his pick for UN, Susan Rice, and her comments about that. And we'll see. Maybe the test case will be over Darfur, and that will be something to look for if there's going to be an Obama doctrine. You know, Iran and Russia and Iraq and Afghanistan and all these things are issues. Then there's the ones that the media doesn't tend to focus on because they're not as important on a daily basis, like Taiwan or you know, free trade in general, issues and so forth. So,
well, I hope you'll come back and talk with us about some of these issues in the future.
Do.
Thanks a lot. Lamont Colucci is a professor of international relations and national security at Ripon College, author of Crusading Realism, The Bush Doctrine, and American Core Values After 9/11. Thanks to Rob Ferret, Bill Martins, and Cynthia Schuster for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.